to happen to a surveillance team in recent history, and communication had nothing to do with it. Trained observers generally relied on a set of known habits and best practices. But just as a baboon might alert the gazelle of a leopard's presence in the wild, being noticed by the local populace was a surefire way to spook a target. Since most noses had become buried in a phone screen, it was a safe bet that a person could spend a couple hours browsing local stores in a 3-block operational area without drawing so much as a second look. That time more than doubled if a stop at the neighborhood coffee shop was added to the mix. City crews had already come by and dropped off wooden barricades in front of Parisia Aires Criollos. These 10-foot-long sawhorses leaned against a row of garbage bins, causing pedestrian traffic to split and flow around them like water around a boulder in the middle of a river. Uniformed officers began to arrive approximately an hour after Ryan and Midas came on station. The newly formed Buenos Aires City Police looked to be playing second fiddle to the beret-wearing Grupo Alacrán, the elite scorpion group of the Gendarmería Nacional Argentina. Dour-looking men with H&K MP5 submachine guns and Steyr AUG assault rifles deployed from 2 4-door Volkswagen Amarok pickups and a white Mercedes-Benz communications van on either side of the restaurant door. Right-wing death squads during Argentina's dirty war of the 1970s and 1980s left the population suspicious of the military, or anything that resembled it. The army was not allowed to take part in civilian affairs, but the government got around this by describing the GNA as a civilian security force of a military nature. The Scorpion group looked about as military as they came, but then they had to be. While other squads within the Gendarmería provided Argentina with border security, Grupo Alacrán was tasked with the mission of combating terrorism and often assisted with the protection of Argentine and visiting dignitaries. These new arrivals set up the wooden barricades quickly, forcing pedestrians to cross Avenida Santa Fe in order to go east or west, rather than walk in front of the restaurant. Ryan and Midas quickly found themselves outside the perimeter, half a block from the restaurant. The presence of men with machine guns upped the feel of the operational tempo, putting Ryan and Midas on their toes. Buenos Aires had seen more than its share of domestic terror, with a recent bombing in front of a Gendarmería building. Members of the Scorpion group eyed people in the passing crowd as if they were food, their mean mug looks sending people across the street as surely as the wooden barricades. A dog handler with a visage as fierce as that of his Belgian Malinois stood at parade rest to the right of the restaurant doors. None of these guys were on a mobile phone. In an effort to remain inconspicuous, Ryan and Midas had looked through the window of every shop for 3 blocks on either side of the restaurant up and down Avenida Santa Fe, some of them twice. Midas was able to work his way up to a vacant 7th-floor balcony above a restaurant called Le Madeleine at the end of the block. Ryan claimed a vacant window seat at the McDonald's almost directly across the street from the dinner meeting venue. He was pretending to surf on his cell when Adara called. He relayed her message to Midas over the radio a moment later. "Chen's moving." "About time," Midas said. "I stopped to gawk at that shoe store down there so many times I was about to have to break down and buy me a new pair of Pumas whether I need them or not. They coming this way?" "She didn't know yet," Jack said. "Don't you get shot up there, brother. These Gendarmería guys look a little jumpy, if you ask me." "Yes, Mom," Midas said. Across Santa Fe, a caravan of dark sedans, each much larger than the bulk of the vehicles in Buenos Aires, began to arrive in front of Parisia Aires Criollos. Men in dark suits dismounted from the front to hold the doors for more important men in more expensive suits as they exited the rear seats. Uniformed Buenos Aires City police officers moved wooden barricades, while Grupo Alacrán operators stood by and glared over their SMGs. Little of this would be for the agricultural delegations. The foreign minister of China was definitely on his way. Personal security was minimal for secretaries and ministers of agriculture, but it wasn't non-existent. Express kidnappings, impromptu abductions of people who looked like they had money, were all too common in South America. To make matters worse, the respective countries of each of these delegations had advertised their attendance well in advance. Some governments, like Japan, sent a security man. Other officials, like the Swiss Minister of Agriculture, were wealthy enough to hire someone on their own to watch their back. Jack made a mental note of each delegation as it arrived. So far, he'd seen representatives from 6 countries: Argentina, India, Japan, Switzerland, Thailand, and the Netherlands. Each minister had at least one security man, and between 3 and 5 assistants. The Gendarmeria had closed the restaurant to regular customers, but it was a relatively small space, and the private function would come close to filling at least half the seats. Ryan looked at his watch. 6:23. Another hour, and it would be dark. It was still far too early for most Argentines to eat dinner, but many of the visiting ministers would be more in the mood for breakfast. 7 p.m. in Buenos Aires was midnight in Amsterdam and 6 a.m. in Beijing. So, concessions for the time differences were made in the spirit of good diplomacy. Ryan's North American stomach was on D.C. time. 6:30 was just about right for dinner. He loved a good steak, but eating one every night after 9 o'clock seemed like a recipe for bad dreams and blood with the consistency of 30-weight motor oil. Ding Chavez broke squelch 15 minutes later, crackling with static as his radio came into range. "You guys copy?" "You're coming in slurred and stupid," Midas said. "Go ahead, boss." Being a retired lieutenant colonel with Delta earned Midas a great deal of latitude. He never would have said such a thing to Clark, but Chavez played by somewhat looser rules in the name of team cohesion when it came to radio decorum. "Roger that," Ding said. "Chen and one of the Asian males are in the Chevy, heading... they're heading south. No. Shit. These streets are all turned around. East on Libertador. Turning south on Ajacucho now. Looks like we're coming to you." "Scratch that." He cut back toward Recoleta Cemetery, pulling over at Adara's ice cream shop. "Copy," Midas said. "We're getting movement here. Gendarmeria has the place buttoned down." "Due respect, boss, but shouldn't we send this information up higher and maybe have someone from state contact the Argentines and warn them of a possible threat? Chen and one actor leaves 3 still in place somewhere." "I ran it by Clark," Chavez said. "He thinks we still have too many variables. He gave me the option, and I say we sit and see what develops, at least for the next few minutes." A tall Asian man with a buzz cut exited the restaurant and gave the officer with the dog a dismissive nod. The pigtail of an earpiece disappeared into the collar of his suit jacket. Ryan made out the telltale print of a pistol over his right hip. A similar bulge on his left side, this one slightly blockier, was surely a radio. The man motioned to the BA City police officers with a flick of his hand, and 2 of them scurried to move the barricades off the street for an imminent arrival. Buzzcut was the advance, on station early, to see that things were safe before his boss got there. A yelping siren drew Jack's attention to the east, and he watched 2 Yamaha police motorcycles nose out from Rodriguez Peña a block away. Strobe lights flashed in the gathering dusk. A black Cadillac sedan stayed tight behind the bikes onto Santa Fe, followed by a shiny black Escalade, and then 5 more sedans. 2 more bikes brought up the rear. It was nothing close to the size of his father's detail, but a 7-vehicle motorcade package with a motorcycle escort was a lot for a foreign minister, even from a country as large and controversial as the People's Republic of China. Jack had read a couple CIA briefs on Li Zhongsheng. For someone so high up in PRC government, little was known about the man, but for the fact that he appeared to dote on his wife and son, and he was apparently quite full of himself. "The ego has landed," Ryan said. "Foreign Minister Li is on site." 10 minutes later, the Canadians and Uruguayans arrived in turn. The gendarmeria posted out front appeared to relax, now that the dignitaries who'd been invited were all safely off the street. "We've got 10 digs inside," Midas said, including Foreign Minister Lee. 30 to 40 staffers and a whole shitload of armed dudes, half of those from Lee's detail." "Copy," Chavez said. Jack took a sip of his coffee. It wasn't White House Navy mess, but it wasn't too shabby either. "Any movement from Chen?"
"That's a negative," Adara said. "They've dismounted and gone into a cafe for dinner."
"You've still just got eyes on the two?" Jack asked.
"Correct," Chavez said. "Chen and one of the Asian males from the airport."
Jack pushed away from his table.
"No females?"
The question was rhetorical. Chavez had already told him who he was watching, but muttering was part of Ryan's process.
"No joy," Adara said, "or the second male."
"Hmm," Jack said. "Both women were here last night, scoping out the restaurant at the same time we were. They would fit in with the locals, so it makes sense for Chen to send them in close while he stays back. I'm betting they're somewhere nearby. Could be they're waiting for a meet with one of the Chinese staffers. Midas, anybody look like they're waiting around with the vehicles?"
"Can't tell," Midas said. "I have a good eyeball on the front door, but from up here Santa Fe's a river of black sedans."
His voice trailed off. When he spoke again, it was in a rasping whisper.
"Jack, didn't you say that Japanese girl you followed had a big scab on her face?"
"Scratches," Ryan said. "Not exactly a scab. Why? You see her?"
Midas whispered, "On the balcony, 2 floors below me, sitting behind a rifle. The girl's running a gun."
Chapter 41.
Inside Parisia Aires Criollos, Chinese Foreign Minister Li Zhengsheng followed his lead Central Security Bureau protection agent Long Yun to his assigned seat. 2 other men, both as stone-faced as the colonel, were posted along the far wall, eyes scanning areas of responsibility on either side of the room. Lee paid the men little heed. They weren't there to be noticed. They were there to protect him, and the good name of the party. The long table was at the back of the restaurant with rustic earthenware settings for 10. As guest of honor, Lee sat at the head, facing the door, his back to the rich mahogany bar that stood nearly 4 feet high. José Prieto, Argentina's Minister of Agriculture, sat immediately to Lee's right under a set of rawhide boleadoras that hung from the wall along with assorted other gaucho memorabilia. A white linen tablecloth partially concealed the air conditioning vent behind the Argentine's chair. Most of the ministers knew one another, some of them quite well, but Annika Bos from the Netherlands was newly appointed and worked the table, introducing herself. She was a stunningly beautiful 50-year-old woman. Most of the men had traveled without their wives, leaving them free to sample the local nightlife. And, perhaps, they seemed to think, explore a cross-border relationship with the Netherlands. A number of them maneuvered for the opportunity to buy her a drink after dinner. Lee kept his face passive, but scoffed inwardly at the thought. Unfortunately for Annika Bos, the lascivious Argentine minister had made certain she was seated beside him. Drinks with anyone would not be in her cards. Prieto tapped his knife against the side of his water glass after everyone was seated and began to welcome the attendees on behalf of his country, calling them each by name as if they were old and dear friends, instead of economic rivals or potential customers for Argentine beef and grain. He jokingly apologized to the Canadian minister that the evening's discussion would have to take place in English, because not everyone at the table spoke French. Lee stopped listening almost at once. He moved as if to readjust his chair, glancing at his watch, and laughed along with everyone else at another of Prieto's asinine jokes, though he had no idea what the man had said. 5 minutes past 7. He could begin whenever he chose to do so.
Lee sat through the picada of baked cheese, cured meats, and crusty bread. Not because he was hungry. He'd already eaten breakfast in his hotel room. But there would inevitably be survivors, and some of them would eventually regain their senses enough to recall things that had been out of place. At 7:20, he leaned back slightly in his chair to get Long's attention. The colonel nodded to the other two Chinese security men, telling them to remain in place and watch his food while he accompanied Lee around the bar to the restroom. The entire restaurant had already been swept for threats, but anyone with a protective detail would see nothing out of the ordinary if Long Yun checked it again. Once in the restroom, Long Yun made a call, making certain Amanda was ready. He spoke quickly, then nodded to his boss, keeping the woman on the line. From this point on, there could be no error in communication. Lee removed a device that looked like a mobile phone from the inside pocket of his suit jacket and entered 6 digits. The first half of the code needed to detonate the small-shaped explosive that he knew was behind the wall vent. It would be a directed blast, not much larger than a hand grenade. There would be a great deal of noise and smoke, and those sitting directly in front of it would be cut in half. The rest of those present would have a very exciting story to tell. To that end, it was imperative that both Lee's hands be visible when the device exploded. Too many things could happen to allow the bomb to be detonated at any specific prearranged time. He'd not risen to his present office by being careless. No, Long Yun would let Amanda know he was in the clear after he armed the device. She would then enter the second half of the code, detonating the device while he was standing slightly around the corner and behind the safety of the thick wooden bar, chatting amiably with the bartender. 60 seconds, Long Yun said. He dropped the phone into his pocket, but kept the line open so the woman could hear if anything changed. Lee began a silent countdown in his head. The bar was close, right outside the door, so he took a moment to wash his hands. The colonel gave an approving nod at his gravitas. He liked to appear in complete control, especially in front of his security detail, two of whom were about to die, though they had no idea. "Be sure to open your mouth, sir," Long Yun said. "It will help with the pressure of the blast. The temptation to look toward the device will be great." "I will be fine," Lee said. With 20 seconds to go, he tossed a crumpled paper towel into the trash can and stepped out the restroom door. It was obvious from the tone of his voice that Ding Chavez was sitting up straighter in the car. "She's on a rifle?" Midas still whispered. "Affirmative. Suppressed bolt action. Looks like a small caliber, maybe a .22 from the size of it. She's sweeping the crowd like she's looking for someone. Holy shit!" Jack stood at the McDonald's window and watched a well-dressed woman with dark curly hair pitch headlong into the crosswalk on the north side of the street. He thought at first she'd stumbled, but it was impossible to mistake the rigid spasms of someone who'd been shot in the brain. Her nervous system short-circuited and she lay on her side, arms suddenly stiff as if she were sleepwalking. Her legs made obscenely grotesque pumping motions as if she were riding an invisible bicycle. A dark wig fell away, spilling tresses of blonde hair onto the pavement. A moment later, her muscles relaxed, and she was still. "It's her," Ryan gasped, loud enough to draw a look from a little kid eating an ice cream cone at the window beside him. The Gendarmeria officer at the nearest barricade also recognized a shooting victim when he saw one. He brought his MP5 to high ready and began scanning the storefronts for a threat. The blonde's body lay half in the street. The light turned green and traffic honked, unaware. For a moment Jack thought she would be run over, but the drivers in the lead slowed down and stopped, forming a blockade, for the moment at least. It really didn't matter. She was beyond saving. Ryan thought of running to act as though he was rendering aid, and maybe grabbing any identification. Midas came over the net again, still a quiet hiss. "Jack, I can hear you thinking. Don't go out there. This shooter is still on her gun." "Sit rep when able," Chavez said, surely feeling blind. Shooter just took out the blonde from the airport, Midas whispered. Suppressed subsonic 22 and a bolt action. I didn't hear shit and I'm 20 feet above her.
He's right, Ding said. You stay put, Jack. I mean it.
Ryan started to say he understood, but a familiar face drew his attention across the street. A crowd of panicked pedestrians braved the traffic to cross against the light directly toward Jack. Amid the fleeing pack, a tall woman with her hair tucked up into a baseball cap walked briskly, working to go just fast enough to stay in the middle. She carried a mobile phone in one hand, and with the other she tugged at the bill of her cap. It was the brunette Jack had watched disappear into Villa 31. A look of barely controlled panic flashed in her eyes. She'd just watched her friend die, and it was obvious she thought she was about to be next. Only the two men of the gendarmerie nearest the dead woman realized something was amiss. The second, though highly trained, had never seen anyone in the throes of death. Too far away to see the tiny spot of blood below the woman's left ear, he thought she might be having a seizure, something she would get over, and it took him almost a full minute before he radioed his command post to request an ambulance. He was on a protective detail and did not leave his post at the door to the restaurant. The officers in the room heard the call go out to the command post reporting a possible heart attack victim and turned their attention back inward to watch the staff. After all, this was a steak restaurant. Virtually everyone in the place had a blade. Lee Jong-sheng stood with both hands up on the bar and fumed, trying to think of something else to say. It had been well over a minute since he'd entered his half of the code, but nothing was happening. The bartender did not speak English or Chinese, the only two languages in which Lee was conversant, making this an extremely uncomfortable predicament. Long Yun stood to his left, carefully positioning himself between the far wall and the foreign minister, but making certain to keep his body behind the protection of the heavy mahogany bar. Lee nodded stupidly at the bartender, forcing a smile that he was certain made him look insane. He kept his feet planted, but tilted his head to the side toward the colonel. Anger knotted with the anticipation already in his gut.
"I cannot stand here forever," he whispered. "Something has gone wrong. Abort?"
That fool, Prieto, shouted across the room as if they were at a sports match. "Mr. Foreign Minister," he said, "please come and resume your seat." Lee held up a hand, signaling that he would be a moment longer. What was the girl waiting for? Minister Prieto stood and motioned toward Lee's chair with a flourish, as if he would not take no for an answer.
"Please, senor, I will order you a special drink if you wish, but it is no meeting without our guest of honor."
Lee clenched his teeth, hardly able to breathe, let alone speak, he was so livid. He reached into his pocket to retrieve the device with which he could enter the abort code. At the same moment, the west wall of the restaurant belched a great ball of dust and debris. The explosion was not a huge one as explosions went. Lee had seen much larger. Still, the concussion in the confines of the small restaurant was deafening. The initial blast knocked Jose Prieto completely out of his Italian loafers and threw what was left of his burned and mangled body across the table. Annika Bos was killed instantly, her beautiful face slammed into her water glass. The Japanese Minister of Agriculture would certainly die as well from his massive head wounds, but he lingered now, trying in vain to staunch the trickle of blood and brain matter that obscured his vision. The blast also claimed one of the two Central Security Bureau men who'd been left to guard Lee's food, a necessary sacrifice to make the story of his miraculous escape even more plausible. Long Yun was on the radio immediately, calling the limousine forward to evacuate the foreign minister. Security personnel from all the delegations, some more professional and experienced than others, stumbled around overturned chairs and burning tables to locate their charges amid the smoke and chaos. The ministers of Uruguay and India had been seated closest to the door. They both ran from the building, abandoning any thought of a security team. The concussion of the blast had shattered the restaurant's large front windows, startling locals who were not unaccustomed to bombings. Most fled for fear of secondary explosions, but some paused long enough to snap a few photographs of the escaping ministers, who now stood with hands on their knees, coughing and sputtering and trying to get their bearings. A Chinese CSB agent with very short hair burst from the front door and shoved the Uruguayan minister out of the way, while Long Yun dragged the limping foreign minister through the melee and to the waiting motorcade. Foreign Minister Li Zhengsheng smiled within himself when he saw at least a dozen mobile phones aimed in his direction. With any luck, some of them had gotten it on video. Jack watched the leggy brunette turn as soon as she crossed the street. The moment her feet hit the sidewalk, she began to fiddle with her mobile phone, and the front doors blew off the restaurant. The sudden woof of pressure shook the window, causing Ryan to take a half-step back. Car alarms up and down Santa Fe began to chirp and wail. The brunette walked briskly away from the blast without looking back, conspicuously ignoring the carnage going on behind her. A moment later, members of Lee's protective detail emerged from the smoke through the front door and whisked him away. Pretty damned efficient security, Jack thought. Midas spoke again, panting now, voice hollow, like he was running down a stairwell. "Our Japanese girl's about to DD Mao out of here," he said. "Keep eyes on the brunette. I'll stick with this one." Ryan located her easily, moving away through a still confused crowd without looking back. "Got her," he said. Ryan all but flew out the door, against the river of people now fleeing across the street toward him. The brunette was a block ahead when he spotted her again, moving north at a fast trot. "Brunette's coming at you, Ding," Jack said. "I'm half a block behind her on Cashau Avenue." He briefed Chavez and Adara on the situation as he moved, using the crowd and darkness to keep from being seen. If she had anyone running counter-surveillance, Ryan knew he was screwed. But she'd detonated the bomb. He couldn't just let her walk away. Chapter 42. Ding Chavez and Adara Sherman sat at a sidewalk cafe nursing cold bottles of Quilmes Patagonia beer while they listened intently to the drama playing across their earpieces. They were too far away to hear the report of the blast, but they'd been able to tell something was up from the alarmed reactions of Midas and Jack. Ding stifled the human urge to ask questions and give advice. He wasn't on scene, and Jack was doing a good job of keeping him up to speed as things went down. It was best to keep his mouth shut and let the operators do what they did best. Operate. And anyway, things were about to get interesting here. At 8 blocks away, the brunette would be there in minutes. Adara suddenly tipped the neck of her beer toward the Italian restaurant 2 businesses to the east. "Chen's moving. Looks like he just put 1 cell phone in his pocket and took out a second. He's in comms with somebody." Chen put the 2nd phone away and walked to the street with another Asian male. Both men looked up and down the wide sidewalk before trotting diagonally across Junin and turning left to walk briskly along the 15-foot brick wall surrounding the cemetery. Chavez peeled a couple 100-peso notes off the roll in his pocket and left them on the table. Tipping was outside the norm in Argentina. The waitress would think him an idiot turista for leaving the equivalent of $12 for 2 beers that cost half that. But it was better than her chasing them down the street for leaving too little. Chavez pushed away from the table and held up the flat of his hand, signaling for Adara to hang back while he took the 1st eyeball on Chen. She nodded and crossed the street directly, while he took a more diagonal route to intercept Chen's trail immediately. She'd follow at a respectable distance, and the 2 would leapfrog, so as to give a fresh face to the follow. Chavez slowed a half step when Chen and the other man hung a right at the end of the block, still following the cemetery wall. Chavez continued across the street and then turned right himself, so as not to round the corner where Chen had gone without checking it out first from a different vantage point. The 2 Asians were still moving steadily, not quite trotting, halfway down the block now. "Got your right," Adara said, letting Chavez know she'd seen the turn. Ryan and Midas were still giving a play-by-play of their individual pursuits. Chavez waited for them to pause, then claimed the airspace.
"Listen up," he said. "We got a lot going on. Keep the bullshit to a minimum. Necessary traffic only. Speed, direction, and any threats. Got it?"
Ryan responded with, "North on Cachao."
"North. Rodriguez Peña. Behind the shooter," Midas said, still running.
"I'm right behind you, Ding,"
Adara said, for Midas and Jack's benefit. Chavez started to give his location when the two men ahead of him broke into a run, taking another right at the end of the block. Adara picked up her pace.
"They see you?"
"I don't think so," Chavez said.
He called out the location, following his own orders so Jack and Midas could keep up with the common operating picture. He trotted now, again swinging wide around the corner to avoid an ambush. He made it around in time to see the second Asian scale a construction fence behind Chen. Both men scrambled up some scaffolding to the top of a construction trailer, and then bounded over the cemetery wall and out of sight. Adara ran up behind Chavez, turning to check behind herself as she came to a stop. It was long past the time to try to stay covert if anyone was trailing them down the dark street.
"You sure they didn't see you?" Adara said again.
Both she and Chavez cupped their hands over their chests, blocking the neck mics so they didn't clutter the radio net.
Chavez said they never looked behind them.
"Cemetery gates are locked up for the night," Adara said. "We'll have to go in the same way they did."
Chavez rubbed his face and studied the construction trailer, his mind racing. He'd been in leadership positions in the last 2 decades. Hell, he'd led a team of some of the most elite operators with Rainbow. But life was so much easier when he'd been an impetuous troop and could let the bosses worry about the magnet in his ass that pulled him, without thinking, toward danger. He'd never been very good about aborting a pursuit, but he reminded himself that he had the entire team to consider. Like a good leader, he made the decision look as though it was second nature. First rule of following someone blind into a dark alley? Is not to follow someone blind into a dark alley, Adara finished his mantra. It was one of many, and she knew it well.
You gotta admit, the cemetery is a heck of a good SDR. It's a maze in there. They'd know for sure if we followed them in.
The problem with an alley, Ding said, toying with the beginnings of a plan, is that you're walking into a fatal funnel. That is, the way you're expected to walk in. We just need to find a different way than the one they used.
"Hello, Midas," Jack hailed his fellow operator, once he'd learned Chen had gone over the cemetery wall. "What's your position?"
"Rodriguez Pen,"
he said, cutting out, still breathless. "You're moving parallel to us," Ryan said. The brunette moved more quickly now, still walking, but much faster than the rest of the crowd. She touched her ear as she jigged around a bus stop shelter, in comms with somebody. Looking right at the next intersection, she paused for a split second, then ran across the street to her left.
"She's coming toward you, Ding," Jack said. With his eyes on the brunette, he didn't see the oncoming Japanese woman until it was too late, and the two ran headlong into each other.
The woman bounced away, falling sideways, spitting like an angry cat. Ryan was stunned from the impact, but able to remain standing. He reached down to offer the woman a hand, but she slapped it away, springing to her feet, ready to run again. Midas had caught up by now and grabbed a handful of her collar, giving it a yank, lifting the sputtering woman off her feet. She'd been holding a cell phone when they collided, and it now lay on the ground with a badly damaged screen. People on the street were still stampeding away from the bomb blast around the corner, and ran by without interfering.
"Let me go,"
the woman said it through a clenched jaw. Her English was accented English, but very good.
"She's escaping."
Ryan turned to watch the brunette disappear into the darkness at the other end of the block, then turned back to Midas, both hands up, as if to say, "What gives?" Midas knew exactly what he meant.
"You can't hear me, can you?"
Ryan shook his head. Midas raised his eyebrows. "Then my radio's tits up. I tried to tell you we were coming. Took me a half a block to realize I wasn't hearing my own voice." Chavez came across the net, unaware of this new development.
"We're walking toward you on south side of the cemetery," he said.
We're trying to find a way in that won't get our asses handed to us.
Copy, Ryan said. Midas is with me, but his comms are down. I've lost sight of the brunette. We're having a talk with our Japanese friend.
Chavez's dismay was apparent.
You made contact?
Ryan rubbed his aching ribs, injured for a second time by a female hurtling through space.
We sure did, he thought.
He said, I'll explain later. He relayed Chavez's situation and location to Midas.
The Japanese woman reached for the shattered phone, but Midas wrenched her arm back with the hand that wasn't holding her neck. She was shorter than Jack by 7 or 8 inches, fit, built like a runner, even restrained, her chin tilted upward slightly, a match to the defiant glint in her eyes. She tried to jerk away, and when she found that was impossible, turned her glare on Jack.
You are wasting time.
I'll take care of this, Jack said, scooping up the broken phone. Close enough to study now, the scratches down the left side of her face looked like they were maybe a week old. Healing, but still pink and quite deep, probably caused by a very determined set of fingernails.
Who are you?
She scoffed, then mocked his tone.
Who are you?
Ryan feigned an unconcerned shrug. The truth was, this woman was beginning to piss him off. He needed to get this done and catch up with the brunette.
You might reconsider that attitude since we just saw you shoot someone in the head.
The Japanese woman's eyes went momentarily wide, but she regained her composure quickly.
Have it your way, Midas said, increasing his grip on her arm until she winced. I guess you'd rather talk to the police.
Bacallero, she spat. You fools! I am the police!
Chapter 43 President Ryan sat in the Oval Office, waiting, mulling over what he was about to say. An 8x10 color photograph of a smiling sailor with rosy cheeks looked up at him. The 20-year-old sailor sat in front of an American flag, wearing enlisted crackerjack blues and a white Dixie cup hat. It was one of those boot camp graduation portraits that proud grandpas and nervous parents keep on the mantle. Petty Officer Third Class Stephen Ridgway had helped save a life, a woman under attack from pirates, no less. Parents would want to know that.
Wouldn't they?
Ryan would want to know, if something happened to one of his children.
That was the thing about death. It was always personal.
Somebody else's kid died, and you immediately thought of your own. How fickle life was. How incredibly easy it was to snuff out the spark that made someone alive, no matter how brightly it burned.
Betty Martin's sure voice came over the intercom.
Mr. President, the White House operator has Randy and Lois Ridgway on the line.
Thank you, Betty.
Ryan took a deep breath, attempting to settle himself. Best not to think about things like this for too long. It made the speeches sound canned. Truth was, he thought about it all the time. He couldn't help it.
Mr. and Mrs. Ridgway, he said, this is Jack Ryan. I am so very sorry for your loss.
The condolence call lasted 4 minutes. There was not much he could say, at least nothing worthwhile. The Ridgways already knew what sort of man their son was. They didn't need the President of the United States to remind them to be proud of him. Ryan looked at Stephen Ridgway's portrait for another full minute while he thought over his next course of action. At length, he moved it reverently to the side and centered a yellow notepad on his desk. He pushed the intercom button.
It's a Saturday night, Betty, he said. You shouldn't even be here. Go ahead, take off.
Right away, Mr. President.
It was what Betty Martin said when she wouldn't commit to leaving. Her husband probably sat at home sticking pins in a Jack Ryan doll for all the time she spent at the White House.
Seriously, Ryan pressed, I just have one more call to make. I'll get the party on the line for you.
Go home, Ryan said. That's an order from your commander-in-chief. I'll make the call myself.
There are protocols, Mr. President, Betty said.
Very well.
He read back the number written on his notepad, and then said, Now will you go home?
Right away, Mr. President, she said.
The Watermelon Park campground wasn't exactly roughing it, but compared to the bustle of downtown Arlington, Virginia, the picnic tables, drop toilets, and fire pits overlooking the Shenandoah River were a blissful wilderness. It had taken Dr. Ann Miller all the way to Leesburg just to calm down the night before after her command performance at the White House. Her boyfriend was getting sick of hearing the story. Miller wore the same red and black buffalo plaid shirt that she'd worn to the meeting, but she and Eric had spent the day canoeing, so she'd traded the long pants for a pair of swimming shorts. She was strictly a yogurt and blueberries girl back in civilization, but she'd opted to splurge with s'mores tonight. She hunkered shoulder to shoulder with Eric, toasting marshmallows over a snapping fire. It was marvelously dark beyond the chestnut trees, just cool enough to make the heat of the fire against her bare knees feel perfect. She teased at Eric's toasting stick with hers, pushing it out of her way. He chuckled, letting his marshmallow catch on fire, and watched it burn. I guess people who get summoned to the White House should have the prime coal areas.
My thoughts exactly, Anne said smugly.
You know, Eric said, casting a glance at the tent, you being in such demand by the highest officials in the land is a real turn-on. She scoffed. Eric Jordan, a leaf falling off one of those red oaks would turn you on. Eric moved his eyebrows up and down. Depends on where it fell. But seriously, getting called to the White House is a big friggin' deal. Miller's phone began to play the Ride of the Valkyries in her jacket pocket. She'd sealed it in a Ziploc bag in the event they swamped the canoe, and it took her a couple seconds to dig it out. Wonder who that could be, Eric teased. 10 Downing Street, mayhaps? She waved him away and put the phone to her ear. Hello? It was a woman's voice, straight to the point. Dr. Ann Miller? This is she? Dr. Miller, please hold for the President of the United States. Miller stood at once, dropping her stick into the fire. It was stupid, she realized, but she remained there anyway. Eric looked at her like she'd lost her mind. An instant later, Dr. Miller, Jack Ryan here. I apologize for calling so late, but I have some things I'd like you to look over. Would you mind coming by my office tomorrow morning? Eric moved in closer now and pressed his ear to hers, listening.
Of course, Mr. President.
Very well, Ryan said. I'll send a car for you.
No, no, she stammered. I mean, that won't be necessary, sir. We're in the Shenandoah right now. My boyfriend can drop me off.
Shall we say 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, then? Eric feigned a pout after she'd hung up.
Should I be jealous?
She laughed, draining off nervous energy.
I don't know, she said. He is pretty cool. Maybe a little?
She picked up a camp chair and headed to the car. What are you doing? Eric said.
Going home, she said. A girl can't wear flannel to the White House twice in a row.
Ryan hung up the phone at the same moment Arnie Van Dam burst in through the door from the secretary's suite. What's Betty doing here on a Saturday night? He waved his hand before Ryan could answer. Never mind. You need to get to a television. Something's going on in Buenos Aires. Ryan groaned, moving toward his private study off the Oval. Arnie never wanted him to watch TV when good news was breaking. Some kind of bombing, Van Dam continued. Ryan's stomach tightened at the word. Any of our people? It was always his first question. Van Dam shook his head. A meeting of agricultural ministers, I guess. No U.S. representatives were present. The COS scratched his bald head. I'm not sure why, but Foreign Minister Lee was there. It's unspooling even as we speak. Unconfirmed number of dead. Arnie followed Ryan into the small study down a short hall off the Oval Office. He picked up the remote because, God forbid, Ryan should have to turn on his own television. They stood together in silence for a time and watched live reports of shaky cell phone footage. The plate glass windows in the front of what looked like a restaurant had been shattered. Uniformed men and women appeared to be moving in all directions. Two fire trucks were parked out front,
their lights pulsing in the evening darkness, causing the video footage to flare dramatically. Ambulances rolled up on scene, motioned forward by the uniforms. The commentary was in Spanish, and an American news anchor did her best to repeat a whole lot of nothing over and over again. What else could she do? Nothing was precisely what everyone in the United States knew at this point. Arnie asked, "Shall I round up the NSC? The Principal Committee, at least." The Principal Committee was an abbreviated version of the National Security Council, consisting of the DNI, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, DCIA, and a handful of cabinet secretaries. They could convene in the Situation Room, but the number was small enough that they could meet in his office. Ryan thought over the value of calling in even the abbreviated committee on a Saturday evening. "No Americans are involved?" "Not to my knowledge," Arnie said. "But China again?" "Yep." Ryan watched two Argentine firefighters carry a body out of the restaurant in a bag. He shook his head. "No," he said. "Let's just get Mary Pat on the line for now. I want to run a couple things by her." Van Dam sat down at the small desk in the cramped study and went to work getting in touch with the DNI, while Ryan sat back on one of the two tufted leather chairs to watch the coverage from Buenos Aires. The news crawl along the bottom of the screen carried the breaking news message, but with nothing but amateur video coming in, there was little to report. The crawl repeated headlines from the last few hours, including news of Typhoon Caitlin gathering strength 200 nautical miles east of Okinawa. He'd already been briefed on what was then Tropical Storm Caitlin when it narrowly missed the U.S. naval base on Guam. Now the damn thing had turned north toward Yokosuka, Japan. "I have MP," Arnie said. "Want me to put her on speaker?" Ryan shook his head. "On second thought, go ahead and patch in Bob Burgess, too. I'd like to get a sit rep on the safety of the 7th Fleet while we're at it." Chapter 44 Ding Chavez stood with Jack Ryan Jr. on the sidewalk in front of the Fredo ice cream shop, across the street from Recoleta Cemetery. 10 feet away, Midas and Adara flanked the seething Japanese woman. "Impossible to prove," Ding said. "It's not like Koan Chosocho carry around ID cards." The Koan Chosocho, or Public Security Intelligence Agency, was akin to the CIA, FBI Counterintelligence, and MI6, responsible for gathering intelligence and conducting counter-espionage activities against both internal and external threats to the people of Japan. "She has support and training," Ryan said. "It's no easy task to get a suppressed rifle into the country and then set up a sniper hide across the street from an international event. And I did see her following the brunette." "Tell me her name again," Ding said. Ryan looked at the palm of his hand where he'd written it down. "Yukiko," he said. "At least that's the name she gave." "Well, shit," Chavez said. He'd worked with a couple Koan Chosocho guys a few years before. They'd been good intelligence officers, if a bit humorless for Ding's taste. But the IC world was not one where you could name drop. For one thing, cover identities came and went. A real name might get nothing but a blank stare, even if you were both talking about the same person. Chavez walked over to look the woman in the eye. "You've put us in a bit of a pickle," he said. Yukiko glared. "I could scream rape." "Go for it," Chavez said. "I doubt you want to talk to the cops any worse than we do, even if you are Koan Chosocho. Hell, especially if you are." Her eyes flashed toward the cemetery wall. "We waste time standing here." "How's that?" Chavez said. "You are CIA?" Chavez shook his head. "Nice try." The Japanese woman stared hard at him, obviously thinking through her options. If she were truly Japanese intelligence, she'd realize she didn't have many. At length, her shoulders dropped, and she heaved a long sigh. She nodded toward Jack. "Your young friend says they went into the cemetery." "They did." Chavez played along.
That tidbit of information wasn't exactly a state secret. Probably went straight over the far side before we could get around.
Yukiko shook her head. I do not believe that is true.
Adara moved a half step closer.
What then?
The Basilica del Pilar is at the northeast corner of the grounds. Many of the churches in Buenos Aires have underground cloisters where nuns or Jesuit priests...
No, no, no.
Jack cut her off.
No more tunnels.
He said it loud enough that a passing couple turned to look at the crazy turista.
As I was saying...
The Japanese woman gave a half-smile, then turned back to Chavez. Jesuit priests constructed tunnels under many portions of the city. Some believe they planned to build a network so vast as to connect most of the churches in Buenos Aires.
Okay, Chavez said. Let's say Chen took one of these tunnels. Can you take us to the entrance?
Trust me, Jack said. You don't want to go down there.
Yukiko shook her head.
There are almost 5,000 burial vaults in an area covering 50,000 square meters. There may be many entrances, or the way down could be beneath the church itself.
If there is one, Chavez said.
The Japanese woman conceded the point.
This is true, she said, nodding at Jack again.
But as your young friend will tell you, at least one of the tunnels leads to the slums on the other side of the tracks. Vincent Chen has a contact there who offers him protection, a man named Santiago Salazar. He is the father of Amanda Salazar, the Paraguayan woman you followed from the bombing. He is what you would call a neighborhood criminal boss in this Villa Miseria. I placed a listening device against the window of his home earlier today.
Let me guess, Jack said. Right before a guy with a machete chased you back into the sewer tunnel?
Correct, Yukiko said.
Adara sighed. Then he knows the device is there.
Maybe not, Jack said. The guy with the machete never made it back to tell him.
Ah, Adara said. Right.
Ryan turned back to Yukiko. I watched Amanda Salazar cut through the train yard, he said. Why didn't she use the tunnel if it comes up near her father's house?
Would you, Yukiko said, if you did not have to? I believe she suffers from hydrokyofsho, fear of small places.
Claustrophobia, Chavez said.
Yes, Yukiko said, that is the word. In any case, we should hurry. My phone was damaged when you knocked me down. My room is behind the Hyatt on Montevideo. I have another phone there, but they will reach Salazar's very soon. We must hurry if we hope to learn anything of value from the device I planted.
Chavez raised an eyebrow.
Sure you don't have a partner there as well?
Believe me, Yukiko said, if I had a partner, you would be aware of that by now. Chavez looked at the rest of his team. Both Midas and Adara shrugged.
We have to do something, Jack said.
All right, then. Chavez motioned up the street with his open hand, nodding to Midas and Adara.
Feel free to shoot her if she tries anything.
Aye, sir, Adara said. Chavez turned to Ryan as the other two led the way with the Japanese woman in tow.
Notice how she kept calling you my young friend like you were some kind of kid?
Jack chuckled.
Ding, 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 he whispered so Yukiko couldn't hear the name. She's not calling me that because I look like a kid. She's calling me that because you're old.
Get your ass moving, Ryan. President Jack Ryan rummaged through the bottom drawer of the desk in his study while Arnie Van Dam took care of arranging the phone call. Ryan found the golf ball he was looking for and dropped it on the floor. Van Dam looked up at the clunk as the ball hit the carpet and saw Ryan had kicked off his shoe.
What?
Ryan said, rolling the ball around under his foot. Van Dam held up both hands.
Hey, he said. This is your office. Who am I to judge?
The phone gave an audible tone, and the White House operator said, Both parties are on the line, Mr. President. The Director of National Intelligence and the Secretary of Defense acknowledged that they were indeed there. Ryan said, Are you guys watching the news?
Just now, Mary Pat said. My deputy called me about 30 seconds before you did.
Same here, Burgess said. They're saying Foreign Minister Lee was injured, but not badly. He'd be a likely target if Joe's behind this.
Could be, the DNI said. One thing's certain. Lee will leverage the hell out of this. Surviving an assassination attempt is a great way to boost political approval ratings.
Don't remind me, Ryan said. My numbers went up 14 points after the bombing in Mexico City. For some reason, not dying is seen as heroic. In any case, we shouldn't discount the possibility that this bombing is related to everything else.
I agree, the SecDef said. If you put together the Orion explosion, the attack on the oil rig in Chad, the USS Rogue incident, and these events in Argentina, all lines converge on Joe.
Maybe, Mary Pat said, but the woman who survived the attack in which the Rogue was involved described the pirates as being Indonesian or Malaysian.
That is true, Burgess said, but I'd put money on finding Joe's fingerprints on the payment to any of a half dozen terrorist groups around Indonesia, as we did with Boko Haram in Chad. He's pissed because our freedom of navigation ops are making him look bad, so he makes a play for one of our ships. Rogue wasn't broadcasting on AIS, and her schedule wasn't advertised, but the fact that they were helping out as part of Malaysian anti-piracy efforts was in all the papers down there. It was no secret that she was to berth in Australia prior to returning to her task force group. The average speed of a Cyclone-class PC is open source. Anyone who wanted to target her would have had to wait for her to leave and start a countdown. Enough yachties sail through that area this time of year heading for Bali or Singapore that it would be easy to grab one when Rogue was presumably close enough to render aid.
A lot of moving parts, Mary Pat said, but it very nearly got the job done.
Not really, Burgess said. We have security measures to keep bad actors from getting too close to one of our ships, but at some point the VBSS teams have to close the distance with the RHIB to do their jobs.
I'm glad you brought up the terrorist groups, Bob, Ryan said. I've asked Dr. Miller to come in tomorrow and do some focused digging. Mary Pat, I'd appreciate it if you could get with her bosses and make sure she's read into anything we have on Lascar Jihad, Jemaah Islamiyah, and that old East Timor independence group we looked into. What were they called?
Revolutionary Front, the DNI said, demonstrating why she held the position she did.
That's the one, Ryan continued. We'll cast a broad net.
Hell, let's get Dr. Miller access to cases on the He-Man Woman Haters Club, if they have a chapter in that part of the world.
Mary Pat chuckled. As soon as we're done here, Mr. President, she said, I'll look into this Argentina thing as well.
Ryan knew by looking into it, Mary Pat would bring to bear the investigative and analytical brain power of the 16 U.S. intelligence agencies under her purview. For all the information silos, turf wars, and territorial fights between the various agencies, when a personal directive went out from the DNI, one could almost hear the collective mental gears turning in Washington.
You're excused then, Mary Pat, Ryan said, and thanks for your work.
Thank you, Mr. President, the DNI said, and then disconnected.
Now, Ryan continued, Bob, bring me up to speed on our ships in the Westpac.
We've moved everyone out of the storm path, Burgess said, or at least we did. This typhoon is all over the damned place. Its westerly course has now veered sharply north, putting it on a collision course for central Japan. The Boso Peninsula gives some protection to Tokyo Bay if a storm comes in from the east, but Typhoon Caitlin is heading straight up the pipe,
leaving Yokosuka vulnerable, Ryan said, picturing the geography around the American naval facility.
Correct, the SecDef said. The storm may well yet turn west again, but Admiral Blackley ordered all vessels out to sea. They'll head north and wait out the storm in colder waters. Even if it continues that way, it'll lose steam.
Very well, Ryan said. He knew Vice Admiral Blackley well and trusted the man's judgment. Let me know if anything develops.
Ryan leaned back on the couch and gave a nod to Van Damme, who ended the call.
The COS drummed his fingers on the desk, eyes narrow. Arnie Van Damme's mind was always moving near light speed, one or two steps ahead of most people in the room, when it came to politics at least. Ryan raised an eyebrow. What's on your mind?
Jack, Van Damme said.
Calling him by his given name was a sure sign the COS was about to dispense some serious advice. I know you, and I know you're counting on this upcoming summit to meet face to face with President Cho. Ryan had the golf ball.